Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS, FM, and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Our topic today is the big switcheroo. The big switcheroo, you may ask? Well, yes. At least we think maybe there was a big switcheroo. You see, last spring, or actually early this past summer, when I was teaching, as I do every summer, at the University of Tennessee Law School and teaching constitutional law there with my many excellent faculty colleagues, one of them in particular reacted very intriguingly when the new Obamacare decision was handed down. You remember that day, don't you, when the Supreme Court, to many people's surprise, upheld the new health care statute? Well, my next-door neighbor at the Tennessee Law School, a fellow by the name of George Cuny, who runs the Clayton Center for Entrepreneurial Law at the law school, is really more of a business type of guy. He's really more of a bankruptcy kind of law professor. But like most law professors, he has a healthy interest in the Constitution, and he had, on the day after that decision was handed down, printed out all of it, almost 200 pages, and in fact had already started reading it. And when I saw him, he was scratching his chin and arching his eyebrows, and I said, "Well, George, what do you think of it?" And he said, "I think something happened here." "What do you mean, George?" He said, "I think somebody switched his vote." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "I think maybe what should have been the majority opinion is actually now a dissent, and what should have been a dissent is now the majority opinion." There was a switcheroo. And George was not the only one. All across this great nation of ours, law professors and other Supreme Court watchers were reaching the same conclusion for many of the same reasons. But few of them, as far as I can tell, ever explained it quite as well as George has. So in a few minutes, we'll talk to George Cuny of the University of Tennessee College of Law, and he'll explain to us why he thinks something happened to change the outcome of that case. But in order to set it up, in order to understand how the Supreme Court and, you know, more generally appellate courts, like the Tennessee Supreme Court, for example, how those courts function, I also spoke to another colleague of mine. She's not my neighbor, she's down the hall, but she's a perfectly delightful lady, and her name is Penny White. Now, Penny is a professor of law at UT, but in her former life, she was an associate justice of the Tennessee Supreme Court. So I could think of no one better to explain the arcane functionings of those courts than Professor Penny White. Let's start with the basics. What does the Tennessee Supreme Court do? What goes on the court there?
Well, the Tennessee Supreme Court, like the Supreme Courts of other states, is the final arbiter of decisions in the state. But also, like most other state courts, they only take the cases they want to hear. Through a process of discretionary review, that's right.
Okay, well, why do we need state Supreme Courts if we've already got the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, a lot of reasons, one of which is to interpret state law, to be the final decision maker on state law, including state constitutions, but also to determine the bulk of cases in the system. The U.S. Supreme Court only takes a very, very small number of cases. So on many issues, the state Supreme Courts basically enforce the constitutional law that's been handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court, unless the state constitution requires them to do something different.
Right, because every state has its own constitution as well, and there's always that interplay between the federal and the state constitutions. But in those areas of law where the state is pretty much exclusive, then you guys are the final authority.
That's right.
Right, okay.
Not we guys, but those guys now.
Those guys now. But a state Supreme Court like the Tennessee Supreme Court. Now, tell us about your experience on the court. What did you do as a justice of the Supreme Court?
Well, The other aspect of state Supreme Courts is that they have an awful lot of authority to administer boards and commissions and to set policy for the practice of law and to set policy for things like indigent defense services in the state. So setting aside all of those administrative duties and focusing just on the judicial duty, on the Tennessee Supreme Court, we basically did two things. First, we decided which cases we wanted to hear. Mm-hmm. And secondly, we heard those cases and issued opinions in those cases.
How did you make that decision? How would a court decide this is a case worthy of our consideration and this one is not?
Well, a lot of it depends upon good advocacy. So the courts would have the opportunity to read what are called petitions filed by advocates, mostly lawyers, not always, not exclusively, but mostly. And the lawyers have the duty to try to point out to the court why the court should hear the case. But more generally, the court would look to hear cases where the law was confused and needed clarifying, or where the law was not established, where there was some sort of void in what the public policy or law of the state really was. And occasionally the court would hear a case just to correct a lower court or an intermediate appellate court's misinterpretation, but that's rare. Supreme courts are really not error correction courts.
Mm-hmm. That is one of the functions of lower appellate courts. I mean, typically you've got three levels in any state, right? You've got a trial court, you've got the intermediate appellate court, and that's called the Court of Appeals here in Tennessee, right?
Right, or the Court of Criminal Appeals, or a divided court.
Okay, so you have an intermediate level that has a criminal and a civil component, and then at the top of that structure is the Tennessee Supreme Court. Now, at that intermediate level, error correction is one of the most important functions, right? If a trial court messes up on the law or even the facts in some cases, the intermediate appellate court needs to correct that.
That's right.
But at least if the system functions properly, most of those errors are corrected at that level. But since you probably have more than one appellate court sitting in the state of Tennessee, you might get inconsistencies between those opinions.
That's right.
And so the Supreme Court would have to clarify that inconsistency. Or, as you said, there might be new areas that those courts simply had not considered yet. And so the court would have to deal with that as well. Because when you're a court of last resort like that, like the Tennessee Supreme Court, occasionally you have to make new law, don't you?
I think that's right. You certainly have to interpret new statutes. And sometimes, depending on how you want to phrase it, some folks would see that as making law. But you know, generally speaking, the legislature sets out the law, the court interprets it, but mm-hmm. there's certainly policy that a court of last resort in a state has to make. And occasionally, the court will just want to go in a direction that another court's going. Maybe, for example, I think of something recent. There's been a lot of states that have become concerned about convictions that are based on things like eyewitness testimony, and so they've done some sort of creative jurisprudence to deal with those issues. Sometimes lawyers will point out that creative jurisprudence that's coming from other states and encourage the state to go in that direction.
So you might actually change existing Tennessee law because maybe something in Arkansas has convinced you the law needs to change.
Yeah, perfect example in the state of Tennessee is going from a contributory negligence state to a comparative negligence state a couple of decades ago.
Big, big difference. And in a nutshell, contributory negligence is if the plaintiff is even a little bit negligent, he loses his whole case. Comparative negligence is you're going to balance the degrees of negligence between the plaintiff and defendant. So even a negligent plaintiff can theoretically collect.
Right.
And that can change the outcome in a lot of cases.
Absolutely.
And you all decided as a Supreme Court you were going to go from one to the other.
That's correct.
Wow, that is a big change. Wow, that's a very big change. Okay, so you've made your decision that a case is worthy of consideration. It's going to come before you. What happens then?
Well, the lawyers on both sides, or the lawyer and a pro se party if the person's not represented, file briefs. And again, a lot of importance is placed upon counsel briefing the case, which basically means making legal argument, pointing out case authority, making legal argument persuasive to the court. So the court reads the briefs, and then at least in Tennessee, in every case in the Supreme Court, unless the lawyers waive oral argument, an oral argument is conducted. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about oral argument in an appellate court. It's not testimony. Witnesses don't appear. It's basically a very short opportunity, usually 20 to 30 minute opportunity, for the lawyers to tell the court why they should win. And it's very different from the kind of argument that a lawyer would make to a jury. It's a law-based argument, telling the court what the law is and why the law should be, or the court should decide the case in a certain manner. And then after those oral arguments, the court deliberates, similar to a jury, but they're deliberating over a legal issue, deliberates and makes sort of a tentative decision as to how the court should come out.
Now that's done in private, right?
That's done in private.
Okay, so you have your oral argument, you ask your questions, and the judges can ask questions, and then do you immediately go back to a conference room, or do you have a meeting later? How do you all do it?
Well, I think it depends on the court and the Chief Justice, but my practice and experience was to deliberate the cases immediately after oral argument. And again, the decision that's reached after oral argument is tentative. All Supreme Courts, state Supreme Courts, have multiple members. So even though sitting around discussing the case, all the members may agree, or a majority of the members may agree to come out one way or the other, someone's got to write that agreement out. So they've got to write the decision of the court. Once that decision gets written and circulated...
Let me interrupt you. How do you decide how many members are on the Tennessee Supreme Court?
The Tennessee Supreme Court has 5 members.
5 members. It's a good odd number. So you're going to get, again, a majority. The U.S. Supreme Court, of course, has 9 at the moment. So how do you decide which of those 5 justices is going to write that opinion?
Again, I think it varies from court to court, but in Tennessee, that's the Chief Justice's decision. Mm-hmm. The Chief Justice assigns the cases. And I think that's fairly customary or fairly ordinary from state to state. But let's take 2 different examples. Let's take an example in which during the oral discussion between the justices, there's a disagreement. Then the Chief Justice might look to see, okay, which side is going to be in the majority and assign a person to write the majority opinion. The other circumstance in which everyone seems to be in agreement, the Chief Justice might just try to be fairly even in the division of labor so that no justice is having to write far more opinions than another justice. But once, in either scenario, once the person sits down and starts to write, words on paper sound very different from a nice conversation in a roving room or in a judicial deliberation room. So once that opinion is drafted and circulated, people who have sat around the table and agreed may begin to see things differently. So I've had situations in which a majority turned into a dissent, or a dissent turned into a majority. So that oral discussion in which a tentative decision about the case is reached is very, very preliminary.
In other words, justices might change their mind.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Might change their mind after receiving the written opinion, or might change their mind just because they've thought about it after the oral argument, or maybe they've reread the briefs and some lawyer raised a point that wasn't clear to the justice at the time of the oral argument. Justices are human. They may think they understand an issue and reach a decision, and then upon contemplation determine that they really didn't understand it. They need to look at it differently.
I think I know the answer to this question then, but I'll just ask you, do you think that oral argument is important then? Or do you think that cases could just be decided on the briefs in most circumstances?
Oh, I think it's critical. Unfortunately, I'm a rather idealistic judge, and always was. Maybe that's why I'm no longer a judge. I do think that there are appellate courts, I know that there are appellate courts who wish to begin a process of only inviting oral argument because they don't think it's as important. So I'm certainly not claiming to have the same point of view as other judges on that.
That's interesting. I've heard oral argument described as a conversation between the advocates on the one side and the judges on the other. I've also heard it described as the advocate's last chance to sit in on the deliberative process and explain any questions that people might have, about the briefs and to really drive home what they think are the most important arguments, or even most importantly, answer the questions and address the doubts that justices might have. So certainly from an advocate's perspective, I've always thought it was very important, and I find it disheartening, actually, as an advocate or a potential advocate, to think that some justices or some judges, some appellate judges, don't think it's important.
Well, I know that even in some of the federal circuits, you only get to argue if invited. So some judges obviously think that they can get what they need on the briefs. A well-written brief might help a judge in most circumstances to reach the right decision. But I think it's not just the oral argument, but the fact that a collective group of people have heard the argument simultaneously and then adjourned to a room, even if it's not immediately, and discussed it shortly after hearing it. I think that part of the deliberative process is what is lost if cases are just submitted on the briefs.
Yeah, you know, you read a brief by yourself, you know, in your office someplace, maybe on an airplane, mm-hmm. wherever it is, and you reach a certain tentative conclusion. If you make a decision entirely on that basis and you're not willing to even consider changing it, you miss the benefit of time, of just letting it gestate in your mm-hmm. mind, and you miss the benefit of other people's perspectives. I mean, maybe even your fellow justices. Did you ever find during an oral argument, if I may ask, that it was some other justice on the court who was more persuasive to you than the advocates?
A part of oral argument is in some justices' minds, lining up their allies for the decision they wish to reach.
Oh, so they're talking to each other.
Not exactly. They're asking questions in order to enable the advocate to talk to that other justice down the bench who may be leaning one way or the other. Good judges let someone else answer the questions.
Ah, so a little strategic questioning. So if I'm a justice and I want to come out a certain way on a case, and I know that my colleague on the other side of the table there, on the other end of the bench, is inclining the other way, but I also know that what his doubts are.
And you know what's important to him or her.
Ah.
Then you ask the question and allow the advocate to answer it. The only downside is sometimes advocates aren't as good as you would want, and they don't get the answer right. But certainly, and that also goes back to the idea of a judge or justice changing their mind, his or her mind. We have to acknowledge that sometimes other reasons affect the decision not to stand firm on a particular case. And I don't mean that to sound sinister at all. I mean, a judge may feel, well, we should decide this case this way. But if we decide it the other way, that's still okay with my, you know, view of the law. And if I decide it the former way, Justice A, B, or C may become alienated against me.
A little bit of politics goes on.
A little bit of politics. I was trying not to use that word.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, politics, to my mind, is not a dirty word.
Right.
I mean, politics is, and it's often been said, is all of life is politics. Politics within families. It's just another word for human relationships. So if I understood you correctly, you're saying that at least in a case where you could go either way, at least in a close case from your perspective, that a given justice might very well say, you know, I'm going to gain some traction with my friend on the other side of the bench there, and maybe down the road he'll be willing to do the same in a case that's important to me, where he feels it's a close call, or she feels it's a close call.
Right, and it's not necessarily that direct. It may be, let's say you and I are on the same panel, and I have a point of view, and you have a different point of view, and I listen to you, and I think, well, that's okay. Yeah, Stuart, you're really wise on that point. I may use it as a way to flatter your point of view and build relationships.
Right.
Which will affect maybe how you react to my point of view in the future.
And that's the way the world works. That's the way human relationships work. And there's and another word for that is called compromise.
That's exactly right.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I've been speaking with Professor Penny White, former Tennessee Supreme Court Justice Penny White, generally about the appellate process, the process that appellate courts go through when they review a case. And now we're working our way towards a discussion of the alleged switcheroo that occurred at the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, on the healthcare decision recently. But before we can get to that point, we have to talk about what appellate courts do. And lo and behold, Some of it's political, some of it's compromise. And compromise is not a dirty word. In fact, let's talk briefly about somebody else who knew all about compromise and all about politics. Let's have our Madison Minute.
James Madison surrounded himself with strong women who influenced his political and social views. The most notable was undeniably Dolly Madison. But there were other influential women in Madison's life, including abolitionist Frances Fanny Wright. Wright corresponded with Madison and even visited Montpelier following Madison's retirement from public office, where she challenged Madison's views on slavery. While the two failed to resolve their differences, Fanny wrote with the highest respect for Madison, while he reciprocated with great respect for her. Madison assured her that although his opinions of abolition may, quote, not coincide with yours, I hope you will not question either my admiration of the generous philanthropy which dictated it or my sense of the special regard it evinces for the honor and welfare of our expanding and, I trust, rising republic. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll speak some more to Professor Penny White and Professor George Cuney about appellate review and whether it's ever appropriate for appellate judges to change their minds. Well, it's that favorite time of the show once again. Kelly is with us, the quiz lady from James Madison's Montpelier. How are you, Kelly?
I'm well. How are you?
Doing extremely well. Who do we have on the line today?
This is Nick Arms from Harriman, Tennessee.
From Harriman? Where is Harriman, Tennessee?
It's actually about 20 minutes west of Knoxville. It's a small town.
I see. 20 minutes west of... That's near Tellico, isn't it?
Actually, Tellico is a little more north of Knoxville.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Harriman is closer to Oak Ridge, if you know where that is.
Yes, yes, I do know where Oak Ridge is. You're not glowing at the moment, are you?
I don't think so.
Just glowing with happiness, but I'm talking about radioactivity here. No, okay. Yes, we know about Oak Ridge.
Our microphones are lighting up.
They actually are. They're lighting up on this Sunday. You got something going here. All right. Well, Kelly, what question do we have for Nick today?
All right, Nick, I have a question for you about the Bill of Rights.
Great.
All right, and here it is. The United States Bill of Rights, and I'm going to give you four choices, which you get to decide which one's correct. The United States Bill of Rights has A, always been designed to protect individual rights from the abuse of federal power. They have never been applied to what state governments can and cannot do. B, has always been designed to protect individual rights from abuses committed by both federal and state legislatures. C, was originally directed at the federal government, but recent court decisions have established that all of the Americans apply to state governments as well. Or D, was originally directed only at the federal government, but recent court decisions have applied some of the amendments to state powers as well.
Okay, well, those are very interesting choices. Why don't we go through them one at a time, and then Nick will ask you to say yay or nay as we go through it and tell us your reasons.
Okay.
What was A again?
A, the United States Bill of Rights has always been designed to protect individual rights from the abuse of federal power. They have never been applied to what state governments can and cannot do.
Okay.
Okay, I think we can take A off.
How come?
Well, primarily because I'm thinking about the First Amendment right now, and I'm pretty sure it says no state shall.
Ah, okay, so you think some of the amendments actually say something about the states in them?
Yes.
Okay, well, that's a good reason not to just apply to the federal government. If it's true. Okay, so we'll cross an A off. Okay, what do we got? What's B, Kelly?
B, the United States Bill of Rights has always been designed to protect individual rights from abuses committed by both federal and state legislatures.
I think the correct answer may be B, But let's table that and move on to C.
Ooh, let's table that.
I like table that.
Sounds,
that's good.
He sounds very official there. Okay.
That's good. We'll have to bring him back.
Okay. You're too short just for saying that.
C was originally directed at the federal government, but recent court decisions have established that all of the amendments apply to state governments as well.
And that one sounds good, too, primarily because I'm thinking, I know the 14th Amendment isn't in the Bill of Rights, but that applies some of the Bill of Rights to the states, I think. So let's move on to D and see if we can get D out of here as well.
D, sure.
Okay. What was D?
D was originally directed only at the federal government, but recent court decisions have applied some of the amendments to state power as well.
Okay, let's cross off D as well.
Okay, we're crossing off D. Why are we crossing off D?
I can't tell you, actually. It doesn't sound good, I guess, would be my best answer for that.
So we're getting analytical here. It doesn't sound good.
Well, you know, when you're doing a paper or pencil good. Test, you never select D if you're not exactly sure.
Oh, I thought you always selected
strategy,
D.
Strategy.
I thought when I was growing up, it was B or C.
We've got to use some of that strategy. All right, so what do you think it is then, Nick?
Can we hear B one more time, actually?
Sure. B has always been designed to protect individual rights from the abuses committed by both federal and state legislatures.
Okay. And what about C?
What about C, Kelly?
Was originally directed at the federal government, but recent court decisions have established that all of the amendments apply to state governments as well.
This
is where it gets tricky because it has the all or the never, or the, you know, you have to play with
right,
the wording there.
And back to strategy, you know, it's all and never is
or some.
Usually not the right answer, it seems. I'm just going to go out on a limb and say B, actually.
You're going to go out on a limb and say B.
So he said
yes.
That the United States Bill of Rights has always been designed to protect individual rights from abuses committed by both federal and state legislatures, and I believe he rationalized because Amendment 1 says states, the First Amendment protects states from protecting our rights.
Okay. You going to stick with B then, Nick?
I think so.
Kelly?
Nick, you should have gone with your rationale and not go with the alls or nevers. It was D. It was originally directed only at the federal government, but recent court decisions, and here's the key word, recent court decisions applied some of the amendments to state power as well.
Great.
Oh,
man, I was way off.
No, well, kind of. You missed it, but, you know, that's okay. I think maybe what you got misled by is that the 14th Amendment does say no state shall, and it was one of the first amendments to actually say that, and that's a very important part of the 14th Amendment, but you also know the 14th Amendment is not part of the Bill of Rights. That's just the first 10, and actually the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law.
Yeah.
And
okay.
So, and that would have, if you'd remembered that, that would have given you your answer, and that's essentially what has happened. It was really between C and D.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because the Bill of Rights very clearly started out as protecting us against this brand new federal government. People were afraid of it.
Absolutely.
People referred to the federal government sometimes as, in Hobbes's famous term, the Leviathan, the sea monster. It was such a huge, ominous presence that they had this Bill of Rights to protect themselves from it. And it was only later, in fact, much later, mostly during the 20th century, that those individual rights also protected us against individual states. Up through the 20th century, states were not restricted in what they could do by the Bill of Rights. And so that's been a very important development. But here's another little twist. Not every single part of the Bill of Rights has been, as we like to say, incorporated against the states. There are still several of them out there that, technically speaking, only apply to the federal government, most notably the Third Amendment.
Can we give our friend Nick extra credit if he knows what the Third Amendment is?
What's the Third Amendment,
It's my
Nick?
Favorite and most obscure amendment.
Oh, you're...
Here's your chance, Nick.
Here's your redemption.
At the moment, you don't have a T-shirt, but you're going to get one if you can tell us what the Third Amendment says.
And it really has no relevance today.
The Third Amendment is the quartering of troops.
he rescued it. This is the first time we've had a quiz rescued.
Redeemed myself. Just redeemed myself.
Right. The Third Amendment says that the government can't quarter troops in your house, which was, of course, a big issue during the Revolution before it. Except during times of war, and Congress has to authorize it, and there are all sorts of requirements, and it simply hasn't come up. And no state's actually tried to do it, and so we don't have a court case. It would be interesting if it ever did come up, if it would be applied against the states. But at the moment, that simply has never been decided.
Never been an issue, but it's definitely an amendment that's a kickback from the Declaration of Independence and all the grievances that Jefferson listed as a government should never do, and quartering of troops was certainly one of them.
No red coats in my house.
That's
right. All right. Well, Nick, thank you so much. That was a very fun quiz, and we appreciate your time.
Had a good time.
Okay.
Thanks, Nick.
Great. Thanks.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. Our topic today is the big switcheroo. Did the Supreme Court change its mind, or did someone on the Supreme Court change his mind? Or her mind, just before releasing the recent health care decision, the Obamacare decision? We're speaking with Professor Penny White, who's telling us all about the appellate review process. And interestingly enough, it's a process that involves compromise.
I think Ben Franklin very wisely said at the very end of the Constitutional Convention that the older he got, the less sure he was that he was right about everything, and the more he respected the wisdom of others. So maybe a way to think of that is just giving other people the benefit of the doubt. You know, if I'm sitting with you on a panel and you're really strong on a point and you think it's very important, well, I might think, I don't really understand where Penny's coming from, but I respect her, and she seems to feel strongly about this, and also it will please her if I go along with her on this, and it'll build my relationship and the comity on the court. So what the heck, I'll vote with Penny this time, even though I have some doubts about it. And, I'll rely on her judgment this time rather than on my own. Mm-hmm. That's nothing wrong with that, is there?
No, and let's make one other point. If I've been assigned to draft an opinion that the chief thinks is going to be the majority opinion, and I circulate it to, say, for example, if on a five-member court, my four colleagues, and three of them are fine with it, and the fourth one says, I don't think I can sign this unless you change paragraph number 11 to soften this language or to add this language or maybe put this footnote in. That kind of compromise can ultimately end up in a much different opinion than what was originally crafted.
Mm-hmm.
I've had opinions that I've written 8, 9, 10 times because it was more important to me for it to be a unanimous opinion, even if it went a little less far than I would have liked to have gone. That was more important to me than getting where I wanted to go. So I would write the opinion in a way to appease or to please or to bring in those one or two sort of iffy votes so that the opinion would end up being unanimous.
And that can be extremely important because, of course, every court has to be worried about its standing and the degree to which the society to which it's speaking, on behalf of which it's speaking, will accept its opinion. Mm-hmm. I recall very famously that Chief Justice Earl Warren was adamant that he not only wanted a certain outcome in Brown versus Board of Education, but he wanted it to be a unanimous opinion. And he worked for months lobbying his fellow justices and no doubt making exactly those sorts of changes in order to get that unanimous opinion. And it did come out unanimous, and it was important that it was unanimous because it encountered, of course, massive resistance. So I see exactly where you're coming from. Sometimes you compromise or maybe even consider changing a vote because you want that unanimity. Maybe you want to give that unanimity to an opinion.
I can't help but think about the last opinion of the United States Supreme Court that I made a copy of, unfortunately for the Forest. It was 98 pages long because of all the separate opinions. And what was really ironic about it is the first opinion, which is usually the majority opinion, when you read it at the very first line, it says it's joined by three justices. So your first reaction is, well, how can this be a majority if there are only four? But the fractured nature of the opinion is such that there are at least five joining in the crucial part of the opinion. So that sort of, I mean, there's a lot of criticism of the present court because it is so often fractured. State Supreme Courts are less regularly that divided.
I wonder if it has anything to do with the length of time a justice has been on the court. I think Justice O'Connor of the U.S. Supreme Court said that after a certain number of years, you leave footprints behind you, and you establish such a line of cases and such a line of reasoning that I wonder if that locks you in. You know?
Well, I do think there's that's human nature, but I think the best judges are those who are able, despite tenure or longevity or whatever, to look anew or to look open-mindedly at any case and not to just be so entrenched in the positions they've taken in the past to lose sight of where we should be. Certainly precedent is important, but there are other issues that are as important on occasion, at least.
Okay. Well, I'll end with the question that brought us here then. Do you have any problem with a justice changing his mind in an important case then? Is there any criticism of simply that action of changing one's mind? Is there anything wrong with that?
There is nothing wrong with the judge considering an issue and changing his mind.
That's been my perspective as well. And is there anything you'd care to add about your experience on the Tennessee Supreme Court or about the process of appellate judging?
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed it. I hope that folks think about the process of appellate judging because they've heard your show and realize what a difference there is in a trial-level judge and an appellate-level judge because, like you, I think the more that our citizenry knows about our courts and our Constitution, the better we are as a people.
It's your weekly constitutional. We've been speaking with Professor Penny White, former Tennessee Supreme Court Justice Penny White, about the process used by appellate courts when they review cases and how sometimes votes change. Now we're going to talk more specifically about the recent Obamacare decision and the suspicions, or I should say the speculations of many people that someone on the U.S. Supreme Court changed his or her vote just before that decision was released. And one of the people who has been learnedly speculating on that topic is my colleague at the University of Tennessee Law School, George Cuney.
Well, George, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me today, Stuart.
Absolutely. Now, I understand that you are among many of the observers, the learned observers of the court who have detected clues in this 193-page opinion that maybe, just maybe, our Chief Justice changed his vote at the last minute.
And I'm not sure it's the last minute, Stuart, but there is definitely a change in position that seems signaled by the paper. And remember, this isn't 163 pages of one opinion. Mm-hmm. There are four opinions there. And the opinion writing process is pretty fluid. Mm-hmm. The justices circulate their opinions amongst each other, looking for backers to join their opinions. And the majority and minority positions can fluctuate. And I think that may have been what happened here. The biggest clue that's available is in the Scalia dissent, which is written not as a classic dissent, especially a Scalia dissent, which are often somewhat caustic and pointed.
Somewhat.
but it is written in the majority style, almost using the royal we the court find this, et cetera, et cetera. And after whatever switch took place, such that a majority was no longer backing the Scalia opinion, the justice did not go back and revise large portions of it. He still refers to the Ginsburg position as the Ginsburg dissent, even though, in fact, it was a concurrence. He does this in a number of places throughout the opinion.
Ah, okay, so just I can put this in perspective. If we assume that that's what happened, that the original straw poll showed five justices, including the Chief Justice, that were going to strike down the law,
and four justices, including Justice Ginsburg, that were going to lose, and were in favor of upholding the law, but were going to lose, then she would have been writing a dissent. She would have been writing a dissent. So the fact that Scalia referred to her opinion as a dissent indicates maybe that's what he originally wrote it as.
It's exactly, and that he was viewing her in that position at the time. Scalia's opinion, in fact, really looks unmodified from before a switch, if that happened, except for the addition at the end of what really is a dissent, and suddenly the voice changes, and it is the classic Scalia pointing out the error of the majority's ways, mm-hmm. Moving forward. So the other clue that is there is that the liberal, largely liberal, majority did not include Justice Ginsburg.
Just before we leave Scalia's opinion, this is fascinating stuff. It's like reading the tea leaves. Or what it really reminds me of is the old Kremlinologists who used to analyze where people were standing at May Day parades and try to figure out what the Soviet leadership was doing in its secret bastion. Well, the Supreme Court's kind of like the Kremlin in that regard. It's sort of a black hole. There's a strong tradition of confidentiality there. And so that's what we're doing. We're looking at these opinions and trying to figure out what do they mean by this. And so it looked like Scalia had this opinion and that he just tacked on something at the end that was more of a traditional dissent. He referred to Ginsburg's opinion as a dissent, which was actually incorrect at that point. And now you're saying Ginsburg's opinion also, her concurrence is...
Her concurrence is very critical of the Chief Justice's majority opinion, and one could postulate that at one time she had been part of the four dissenters that did not include the Chief Justice, and at the last minute joined in the result necessary to get the five votes, but was more in favor of upholding the for lack of a better word, Obamacare statute, mm-hmm. based upon the Commerce Clause, which is what Chief Justice Roberts was Chief Justice Roberts was making plain was not the support for his ruling. He pinned it instead upon the tax power of Congress.
Let's be clear about that, too. The statute was authorized pursuant to two different constitutional powers. One of them is the commerce power, which most people have been arguing about for the last 2 years, whether the commerce power was big enough to authorize this individual mandate primarily. But always out there, and those of us who pay attention, we're always aware that there was this taxing authority as well in Article 1 of the Constitution, which, if anything, has always been interpreted as being even broader than the commerce power. And the fact that the Supreme Court didn't spend a lot of time talking about that the commentators didn't spend a lot of time talking about that's why people are surprised now. They weren't really paying attention to the real law. So the opinion itself, the majority opinion itself, upholds Obamacare, but it does so on the basis of this taxing power. But it also includes, very significantly, a rejection of the Commerce Clause argument. And so constitutionally speaking, one of the most significant parts of this majority opinion is that it limits the commerce power. It says the commerce power is not big enough to cover this individual mandate. And that's the part that Justice Ginsburg not only disagrees with, but vociferously disagrees with. And normally speaking, you might not expect a justice who's in a majority to be that critical of part of the majority opinion. Okay, have I explained that well?
I think you have, okay. And the interesting thing is that from her perspective, and she is, if not the oldest, one of the oldest members of the court, and has had extensive dealings with the medical establishment in this country and seen what that is like on a first-hand basis. Her opinion reads very much like a screed about how much more regulation of medical care needs to be enacted, that Congress needs the power to do this, and she's very much in favor of an expansive reading of the Commerce Clause, which includes being able to regulate inactivity, not just activity. Mm-hmm. So if you decide not to be in commerce, the law can apply to you. Roberts rejects this, and the other liberal wing justices of the Supreme Court joined with Roberts, And that is significant because it does clip the wings of what was otherwise an expanding commerce clause.
Yeah, the more conservative justices. Yeah, the four conservative justices, the Alito, Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas, agree with the Chief Justice that the commerce power doesn't cover so-called economic inactivity.
And so that gives us five of the nine that have taken that position.
Right, and that is extremely significant, and that is why a lot of people who are disappointed with the outcome of this case nonetheless really can claim a major constitutional victory here.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Professor George Cuny of the University of Tennessee College of Law about the big switcheroo, whether the Supreme Court changed its mind just before it released its decision on Obamacare. After the break, we'll find out what's happening this week at Montpelier, and then we'll come back and finish our discussion with George Cuny. Stay tuned. I would like to start all over again. Baby, can I change my mind? I just want to change my mind. Baby, let me change my mind. As I took those steps. All right, Kelly, what's happening this week at Montpelier?
Well, we're going to have our last summer sunset tour of the season on September 14th, which is a Friday. And during this last summer sunset tour, guests can come and enjoy wine and light refreshments, all from the front portico overlooking the beautiful Blue Ridge Mountains. So it'll be a nice time to have a tour of the mansion and also enjoy some libations while you're here.
A very good thing to do. I'm just curious, now why do sunset tours not continue all year long? Does that have something to do with the position of the earth?
Yeah, something to do with the position of the earth.
And the sun, okay.
We don't have control over.
Okay, so the sunsets are best in the summertime.
Yes.
All right,
yes.
The last one is when again?
September 14th on a Friday.
Okay, well, come out on September 14th around sunset and enjoy the last of the tours, at least until next summer.
Yeah, please do. Join us at montpelier.org to learn more information.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Professor George Cuny of the University of Tennessee College of Law about whether the Supreme Court changed its mind just before it released its decision on Obamacare.
Normally speaking, since Ginsburg won, in a sense, we might not expect her to be quite so critical of part of the majority opinion, but apparently she is.
Very much so. In fact, it is not a brief dissent at all. it is many, many, many pages. A brief dissent is personified by Justice Thomas's two-paragraph dissent. Or actually concurrence in the dissent from the other side. But no, Ginsburg goes out of her way to lay out the case that the medical situation in America is in trouble, that we need legislation to address this, that it's a national emergency, and Congress needs to be able to do so. By relegating, and she's fighting against the conservatives who are saying you can't do it with the commerce power, but you can do it with the taxing power, because I think in many ways the taxing power, although it may be broader, is less flexible. Mm-hmm. It has to depend upon enacting statutes that penalize certain behavior. And at some point we go beyond something being a tax and something turning into a penalty. And at that point, the court is pretty clear that penalties are not authorized by the tax code and the taxing power of the Constitution.
Right. When I say the taxing power is considered very broad, it is virtually limitless in the sense that almost any tax will go. But that's implicit. That's an implicit limit. As you say, that's only taxes. If you do something that's not a tax, well, then you're not within the taxing power. And so, yes, there's always some limit on a congressional power.
Contrast that with the Commerce Clause, where if it affects interstate commerce, we can regulate it. And then interstate commerce has had a very elastic definition, including extending to a farmer who wanted to grow wheat on his own land for his own personal consumption. That was going to, according to the court, expand the amount of wheat in interstate commerce because he wouldn't be buying his wheat from someone else, and that justified regulation. Or
Rickard versus Filbert, simply because he was taking himself out of the market to purchase wheat, he was going to substantially affect commerce, or at least he and the thousands of other farmers who might do the same thing if he'd been allowed to do that. We did a whole show on Wickard. Fascinating case. Okay, are there any other clues in the opinion that you can think of that maybe there was a switch here?
I think the biggest one, I'll return to it, the biggest one really is the splintering of the traditional liberal wing of the court, with Ginsburg flying off on one side for her long and detailed argument regarding why this should be commerce, not tax, and Justice Scalia's failure to edit out the evidence that he once was in the majority and commanded a lead.
Now, here's the real speculation. I'm going to ask you to put on your Karnak hat here. Do you think that perhaps Justice Scalia or perhaps Justice Ginsburg left things the way they were deliberately to leave clues that there had been a last-minute switch here?
Would it be to leave clues or to make a record? I think being a lawyer, I think that I would like to put it in terms of making a record, and so that history could be the judge of what went on, and to some extent the secrecy of the court and its processes has been breached as they left their, for lack of a better word, their graffiti, their Kilroy was here on the
their
record.
Fingerprints are evident on these opinions, and that's intriguing to think about whether they, I mean, these are smart people. These are smart, smart people, and they know how closely this will be scrutinized, so it's difficult for me to think that this could be just a drafting error or that it would be a last-minute thing. I mean, if they needed more time, they would have taken more time.
The Supreme Court has the ability to extend its term as necessary.
Exactly.
For this.
So, I mean, I think this there might have been a little bit of intention here, and I don't know. I'm just speculating. Let me ask you the ultimate question. I mean, given that people are so upset by this, and especially people on the conservative side now are very upset that they perceive Chief Justice Roberts as having switched, is there any problem with Chief Justice Roberts switching during the deliberations and the trading of these opinions back and forth?
Well, I don't think that there's a problem there. I think I'll agree with Professor Tribe when he says that's part of the process. The nine are here. They go into conference after oral argument, and they tentatively vote on how they wish to come out. That creates a majority and a minority, unless we have some sort of unanimity. The senior judge in either group appoints the writer for the tentative opinion from that group, and then that opinion is circulated for comment. And other justices are free to dissent or concur separately from that, to suggest changes, to bargain for inclusion of things like footnotes or qualifying phrases. And that's a conversation that interestingly largely takes place, because we're talking about lawyers, in written form rather than around a conference table, as lay people might think about discussing something. And that is the way that the process is supposed to work. I think I would differ from Professor Tribe's conclusion, though, because here the conversation looks dysfunctional. And it doesn't have the smooth conclusion with an edited majority and minority opinion there. It has the look of people getting up from the table and hastily joining the group that they're going to join with, almost as if the music has stopped in the game of musical chairs, and the party is over, and we're just going to leave the documents as they are and close out the term. So I'm not sure that while it does look like a conversation took place, I'm not sure that the record is left behind by the justices makes it look like it was a functional process that was working, rather some dysfunction crept into it.
Well, you know, that happens in any deliberation. If I can rephrase it just so I make sure I understand, there's no problem with the idea of someone switching his vote, because that actually indicates, as Professor Tribe has said, that people are being open-minded, that people are not simply drawing a line in the sand and then refusing to listen.
So, you know, you'd expect it from time to time a justice or two or more would change their votes as they went through the drafting process. So there's nothing wrong with it in theory. But as you say, it looks as if they either got really angry with each other this time or they just got so sick and tired of this process that at a certain point they just said, fine, just send it out. I'm getting out of here.
I think that's right. I wouldn't go so far as to say angry, but I do. There is a sense, especially in the Scalia minority opinion, of I'm fed up, and I'm going to tack on my dissent to the old majority. I'm going to leave all the references in there as they originally were when I was in the majority, and it's time to go on break.
I think that might be the case. You know, and on the one hand, these are extraordinarily learned, intelligent people, very admirable in many respects, all of them, but they are people. They are human beings, and they get tired, and they get testy, and they make vacation plans, and they want to go on vacation, or they want to go to do whatever else they're going to do. And so sometimes it's just time to say, I'm leaving now, I'm taking my toys with me, and we're just going to leave it the way it is.
We're going to leave it the way it is, and we're going to invalidate selectively the legislation, which may mar the legislation itself from Congress's point of view in terms of not fulfilling its grand plan. And maybe that throws it back in the hands of Congress. And maybe that's the legacy of the Roberts switch, because Justice Scalia would have struck the entire law, not severed portions of it. Here it is upheld on what are both broad and yet precedentially narrow grounds for future regulation of healthcare. And the law is, in its somewhat flawed form, based upon comparison to its original form, is thrown back into the hands of
When you say now flawed form, you mean the Medicaid mandate?
The Medicaid mandate has been struck.
Right. So that might not work the way it was intended. Okay, that's what you're referring to?
That's correct. Okay. And already the number of states are saying that they are not going to opt in to the expanded Medicaid platform because they can't afford to after kind of the federal funding phases out, and I think it's 2016. And so this somewhat flawed legislation is left standing, and Congress is there to fix it. And as the Chief Justice said, and as I think even Justice Scalia and Thomas would agree, Congress is the one who passes the law. It is the role of the courts to interpret it, say if it's constitutional or not. But if the law needs fixing, that's for Congress to do. Perhaps the president can propose changes, and Congress, as the old saying goes, disposes of those changes, and the court reviews their work to see if it's good enough to stand up.
Well, thank heaven Congress is never dysfunctional.
There does seem to be a pattern at work here in all three branches of government.
Well, George, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate those you elucidating those clues for us, and I guess we'll all just have to decide for ourselves what we think happened behind the walls of the Supreme Court.
Thank you, Stuart. Been good to be with you.
Thanks very much to George Cuney, professor of law at the University of Tennessee College of Law, who shared with us his wisdom and his learned speculation on the big switcheroo at the United States Supreme Court and the Obamacare decision. Hi, this is Stuart Harris, and I'd like to speak to you about a very special subject. I'd like to make a special plea for a special reason. That is, I want you to call your local public radio station, and I want you to demand, I want you to pound on your desk and demand that your local public radio station start carrying your weekly constitutional. Because guess what? We're not just a podcast, even though tens of thousands, hundreds of, who knows how many of you listen via podcast, but we're not just a podcast, we're a radio show too. We're a public radio show, and we believe very strongly in the power of public radio. So we want to be on as many stations as we can be. And I just know that you have a public radio station near you, and I just know that they need your support. They need your money, and maybe the next time you call in and pledge your support, maybe the next time they ask you what your favorite show is, you can say, well, my favorite show is one that you don't carry yet, and I want you to carry it. It's called Your Weekly Constitutional. That's enough information, because they can just get online, they can Google it, and they can find us, and they can ask us, and we'll be happy to ship our show to your station. In case you want it, our email address is ywc@montpelier.org. Once again, ywc@montpelier.org. Give them our email address, and things will go very smoothly. For them, for you, for us all, thank you for listening to this very special request. And that's our show. Thanks very much to Professors Penny White and George Cuny of the University of Tennessee College of Law. Thanks to our scheduler, Carol Hutchinson. Thanks to our distribution engineers, Larry Mayer and Bob Hoffman. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.